MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker. Good afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
I'm fine, mate. How are you going?
Good, thanks, mate. How are you feeling after well, I suppose, the second week of having COVID, getting
yeah,
over
it's
COVID?
About two, it's about 16 days now. I still have occasional paroxysms of fatigue, but
right.
The throat's still a bit dodgy. But apart from that, I'm okay.
Okay.
Getting over it. I don't think I'm headed to long COVID.
There's a study suggesting that people who catch COVID-19 at least twice have double the risk of dying from any cause and are three times as likely to be hospitalised in the next 6 months compared with people who test positive just once.
Yeah, and this came from the health records of 6 million people who are under the care of the Department of Vets in the US. And they found that 260,000 had had one COVID infection and 40,000 had two or more. And as you so rightly say, the more COVID infections you have, the more chance you have of having other serious comorbid conditions. And I think the reason being is that if you had COVID a couple of times, it's really pulverizing your immune system. So your immune system often goes into overdrive and can inflame other things. And we know that there's a link between hyperinflammation and dementia, hyperinflammation and heart disease and cancer. So I think people should avoid getting COVID if they can. But, I mean, unfortunately, it's a very contagious disease. I have no idea where I got it from. My wife and I got it on the same day. And the family, as I said the other day on my show, the family that coughs together isolates together. And so we're both recovering from it, but I just wouldn't, I do everything I could to try and avoid it for anyone listening, which means getting up to your fourth vaccine if you need it. But I have had four vaccines, and this BA.5 just doesn't care whether you've been vaccinated or whether you've had an infection. You can still come down with it. So take all the precautions that all the authorities are advising.
If you, you say you've had the BA.5, you think you've had the BA.5.
Yep. Can
you get BA.5 again, or if you've had it once, you can't get it again, but you can get, for example, the BA.4?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, mate. I don't think anyone really knows.
Right.
See, the problem with this virus is rewriting the textbooks. So anyone who claims to be an expert on COVID really should be looking at themselves, because no one knows what's going to happen with this thing. No one knows whether this will fizzle out, whether it will go to a totally new strain. We have not seen a new strain of COVID since last October when Omicron took over from Delta. But what we have seen is five or six different sub-variants of Omicron. And it may be that this Omicron just keeps grumbling on to different variants doing different things, because what's happening is the spike protein, which is the bit of the virus that gets that actually gains entry into the cell, just keeps mutating, and it keeps mutating beyond vaccinations and beyond treatments, and we just don't know what's going to happen with it. We don't know whether you can get it twice or whether you can only get one variant once. I just don't know. Some people don't clear the infection properly and basically just get reinfected with the same variant they've had. So who knows?
Okay, let's not talk about COVID anymore.
No, please.
A new study of studies reveals a strong correlation between vision loss and dementia and cognitive impairment. They say that further research should investigate a potential connection. Getting eye examinations and treating vision issues as they arise is beneficial for people as they age.
Yeah, and when you think about that, it's logical. It's the same thing with hearing loss as well. People that have hearing loss have a much higher rate of dementia. And I think one of the reasons for that is if you are not getting the stimulation, either visually or acoustically, then your brain is not being challenged as much. You just don't get the same input into the brain. And so it's just a bit like if you don't use a particular muscle, it gets weak and floppy and doesn't work properly.
Sure.
So again, the visual cortex is, and of our senses, vision is probably the most important.
Even though
all of our senses are vitally important, and vision is the thing that connects you to the rest of the world. So people that aren't getting their regular eye checks, and people that aren't paying attention to any sort of eye disease when they happen, there is a higher rate of dementia later on if you don't get it treated.
I just think that, like you and I have said for years now, you know, you've got to have regular checkups. You've got, once you get over 50, as a bloke, you've got to, you know, have the regular prostate. You've got to have regular heart checkups and all those sort of things. I just, you've got to do the same with your eyes and also your hearing. You've just got to go and have at least a yearly checkup with your eyes and your hearing as we get older.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the problem is, especially you mentioned blokes, men are not as good as women at getting their regular checkups, and I know that. And it's interesting, having practiced medicine for 40 years, I've got two groups of patients. I've got people who follow my programs and people who don't.
Right.
And the ones who follow my programs are the ones who do the best. And what does that involve? That involves, firstly, having the right assessments, exactly what we're talking about at the moment. Having your heart checked, having your prostate checked, your breast checked, your bowel checked, your eyes checked, your ears checked. Secondly, practicing the following all the important lifestyle principles that you and I have spoken about for years, the five keys of being healthy. Number three is don't walk away from orthodox medicine. If you need pharmaceutical medicine, take it. But here's the problem, Brent, that Homo sapiens as a species are a sorry lot. So if I line up 100 people and I put them onto any program, after 12 months, 50% have stopped or changed the advice I've given them. And they often don't let me know. And I'll put someone onto a supplement and say, you're still taking the supplement? Oh, no, I stopped. Why? Oh, I didn't think it was doing much. I ran out. I didn't get round to ring up. There's always some rubbish excuse why they're not doing it. And it's the ones who actually are compliant with their therapies, whether they're drug therapies or supplements, they're the ones who do the best. And finally, what I call contact. People that have a communication and a contact with their physician where they can call their doctor if there's an issue, discuss the problems if there's an issue. And I have patients all the time that ring me and say, oh, Ross, this has just happened to me. What should I do about it? They're the people who do the best. The people that sit on symptoms and wait, they're the ones who do the worst.
Yeah, of course, you know, these days, understandably and unfortunately, it's very difficult to have a good relationship, a regular relationship with your GP. Because if the GP's any good, they're booked out for sometimes months in advance.
But this is the problem with the world in general. There's too many people and there's not enough services to supply the too many people. And so the expertise is being diffused. In medicine especially, what we're finding is because general practice is such a difficult job, and I believe such a poorly paid job for the quality of service that's given, that a lot of people go into medicine, go into specialties. And as I've done, I mean, I've got, I believe, the best job in the world, in my view. But I'm saying many more people are now going to specialties than going to general practice. So there's just not enough good general practitioners around offering the service, as you say.
Death of a family member may increase heart failure mortality risk. Heart failure patients experiencing grief or in mourning following the loss of a close family member are at an increased risk of death, particularly during the first week following the family member's death. This is according, of course, to a study.
Yeah, a study of 500,000 people, of which just under 49,000 had experienced some degree of bereavement during around a 3.5-year follow-up period. And they found, as you so rightly said, that in the first week, especially after the death of someone you love, there's about a 78% increased risk for you dying as a consequence of the grief that you're experiencing. And interestingly, there's a bit of a selection process here. If it's a child, a death of a child, the risk goes up across the board over the full 3.5-year period, about 10%. If it's your partner, lifelong partner, a 20% increased risk, grandchild 5%, sibling 13%, but not the death of a parent doesn't increase your risk. But it's the first week after the death of your partner, your risk for death goes up 113%. So yes, you can die from a broken heart.
Yeah, you can, and people have. Limiting meals to an 8-hour window each day apparently regulates your circadian rhythm of multiple organs. Well, it does anyway in mice, because that's what the study has done. But we're told about intermittent fasting now for years and years and years, and it seems to be there's lots of good reasons to do it, Ross.
Well, there's two things here. One, there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine that came out in April of this year. They looked at just under 140 patients who were obese. They put both groups onto calorie restriction. So they ate the same amount of lesser food over a 24-hour period, but they put one group into the time-restricted eating, so eating for 8 hours out of the 24, but the other group could eat when they liked. But they had exactly the same calories every day. The people who were in the time-restricted eating group lost 8 kilos over the 12 months. The eat-when-you-like group, still calorie-restricted, 6.3 kilos. When they looked at the statistics, there wasn't any difference, but it's still 1.7 kilos is still, I think, a reasonable difference. But when they did the study in mice, the 200 mice, split them into two groups, and this was just a four-week study where they allowed the mice to eat what they liked, but one group was only allowed to eat over a 24-hour period, 8 hours of the 24. The other group could eat when they felt like it, but it was a high-fat, high-sugar, high-calorie diet for both groups. The ones that ate over the 8-hour period had much better indication of good gene expression to reduce the metabolic abnormalities that you see, so less diabetes, less cholesterol problems, less weight gain, just by eating over that 8-hour period. So you say, what's the difference between the New England Journal of Medicine study in humans and the study in mice? The difference is that in the mice, they were allowed to eat what they like, whereas in the humans, they had their calories restricted. So I still think that the bottom line of all of this is it is better to concertina your eating into 8 hours out of the 24, or as close to that as you can get to. And it's also best, of course, to restrict your calories, because in our society, most people eat more food than they actually need to eat.
Yeah. I suppose, again, if you're consciously try to restrict the amount of food you eat, and you're looking at eating in an 8-hour period, psychologically, you're on the right road to be maintaining a good, healthy weight anyway, aren't you?
Yeah, you are, but there's another really key point here. A lot of people work very long hours. They get home at 8 or 9 o'clock at night. They might eat at 9, 9.30 and go to bed an hour later. And that's one of the worst things you can possibly do, because you switch on a set of genes during the day for digestion, but at night time you set on a series of genes to repair your gut lining. So if you eat just before you go to bed, you're switching on the digestion genes. Not a good thing. You don't get good gut repair. And 20% of the population have some sort of gut issues.
Don't become a restaurateur.
No.
Not good for you at all.
No.
Brain electrodes may be a long-lasting aid for severe depression. These electrodes are implanted in the brain, I understand.
They certainly are, and you say, well, hang on a minute, I've got a bad depressive episode, I don't want to get somebody shoving electrodes in my brain, but we're talking about this trial of 25 people with severe, completely refractory depression, and they'd experienced this for 9 years. We're talking about people that had zero social activities, had recurrent suicide attempts, often considering euthanasia. Their life was so bad. So we're talking about the very extremes of severe depression. We're not talking about somebody who says, oh, I'm just not feeling so good today. Because we know that if you have endogenous depression, which is a genetic disease of the brain where the brain chemicals drop, got nothing to do with the fact that you go to a doctor and say, can't stand my partner, I hate my job, my kids are on drugs. That's not depression. That is grief. That's a different issue. Antidepressants do nothing there. Severe depression is a medical disorder that needs medical treatment. So when they took these 25 people and they implanted these little electrodes in the brain and set up this almost like a little pacemaker device under the collarbone with the wires going up under the skin into the brain, they found about 50% of these people had significant improvements in their severe refractory depression. They tried everything, ECT, they tried antidepressants, counselling, nothing worked, but this thing actually seemed to work.
I know it's lunchtime, so we'll do it quickly. Fecal transplants apparently ease irritable bowel syndrome for 3 years. Now, for people that have IBS, they'll look for anything that can help.
Yeah, and fecal transplant sounds really a very impalatable thing to do, so to speak. But this is introduced typically via a colonoscope, where they take healthy donor stools from young people that have no bowel issues, and they infuse it via the colonoscope into the upper bits of the bowel.
Mm.
And it's been found that people who've had these fecal transplants, after 3 years, two-thirds of them are improved. Because irritable bowel, even though it's not a dreadful disease that's going to kill you, it's certainly a horrible condition that can make your life a misery. So this may be something for people whose irritable bowel isn't settling down with the common suggested approaches.
Have they come up with any side effects of these fecal transplants yet?
No. No. So if people have the fecal transplants and the procedure goes well, I mean, the problem with any medical procedure, there's always a rare complication. So with a colonoscope, very, very rarely people can perforate their colon.
Right.
So obviously that could be a complication, yes, of the procedure. But in terms of the treatment itself, there's been no nasty side effects, no.
Just before I let you go, we had an email a couple of weeks ago. I did send it to you. It was in, and with these new rules and regulations, we obviously, as I understand it, we can't mention any brand names, but are you able to talk about your thoughts on olive oil leaf extract, and is it good, bad, or indifferent?
I'm not talking about a product. I'm just talking about the fact that this is a derivative of olive oil or olive leaf extract. And it has been shown in a number of studies, not published in the top-end peer-reviewed journals, but in reasonable journals, a number of studies have shown a benefit in improving immune function. I'm not suggesting it's a miracle at all, but for people who are predisposed to respiratory infections, you may get some benefit from using olive leaf extract.
If your immune system's pretty good anyway, is it going to do anything, or is it basically a waste of money?
Oh, who knows? I mean,
okay.
Some people will respond beautifully to these things. They might get colds all the time and start something like this. Same thing with vitamin C, with zinc. There's a lot of work there. But again, some people will do nothing for it. And it's the problem with all treatments. So we talk about statin drugs to lower cholesterol. They'll always lower your cholesterol, but some people won't get any cardiac protective benefits. Other people get amazing benefits.
Yeah. Okay, Ross, thank you, mate. We look forward to talking to you next Tuesday, as always.
Good on you, mate. Thanks,
Brent. After yourself. Bye-bye. Thanks, Ross. Bye-bye. That's Dr. Ross Walker.